Hello and welcome to Tools in the Shed, a podcast powered by Cars Guide, ready to rip into car stuff that's caught our eye this week. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and with me is our Managing Editor, Head of Video, Matt.
Hello.
And key contributor, Mr. Stephen Otley.
G'day, g'day.
This week, we're looking at Mazda's determination to head up market and whether the strategy is paying off. We'll discuss a trio of recent entries to the Cars Guide garage, and we'll catch up with that crazy cat set to extend the light of consciousness to the stars in this week's must-watch. YouTubers, you can jump ahead courtesy of the time codes in the notes below, and you can click on the chapter markers in the timeline. But before we get going, Stephen, tell us about that picture behind us. We were just talking off air. What is going on behind you?
Yeah, so this guy up here, where was my hand going? This one. This is my great-grandfather, a man by the name of Donald Harkness. He was quite a talented engineer and racing car driver back in the 1920s and 30s. A couple of big claim to fames where he was the first person to break 100 miles an hour officially in Australia. There was a competition set that record at Jerngong Beach. And he also competed in the first Australian Grand Prix. Well, that is the debatable one, whether the Grand Prix was officially at Goulburn in 1927, but obviously there's a dispute that it was 1928 at Phillip Island, so that's a bit of a long story. But this particular car is his predominant race car. That's at Penrith Speedway, but he also raced it at the famous Olympia Speedway in Maroubra in Sydney. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's a big concrete bowl.
Yeah.
That was pretty dangerous. So, yeah, he's a fascinating bloke.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. And it's got that period kind of effect where cars, it's a stationary shot, but you can just get that speed. It's kind of elongated, and it's got a bit of positive camber going on the front axle there as well, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah, that is a heavily modified Overland. So it's got like, if you actually see, I've got a photo of it lined up against its competitors, and the competitors, you know, have that classic 1920s, you know, big boxy radiator where you can see there that he's modified it and given it a bit of a more aerodynamic shape. So yeah, he was a clever guy, but I'm most definitely at the shallow end of that gene pool.
That's right. The strands of the DNA peeled away as the decades passed.
An engineer nor a race car driver.
Well, that is amazing. That is fantastic. Thank you. But let's go. And our main topic for this week is Mazda. And our own Chesto has authored a couple of stories recently. The most recent one focusing on reports out of Japan that the next Mazda CX-5 is going to wave goodbye to the Toyota RAV4 and go after the likes of BMW with its X5 and X6, an altogether bigger vehicle, more powerful, and two different body styles, similar. This is where the X5, X6 thing comes in, a more traditional SUV shape and a coupe-style body, inline six-cylinder engine, and the sportier twin is going to be called the CX-50, allegedly. And the big question is whether or not Mazda's seemingly determined push into a more premium space will work and is sustainable. So I want to get you guys in on that conversation and see what you think.
I would say, starting off, I think Mazda in a lot of people's minds is already in a premium realm. They're getting a sort of semi-premium interior experience, which a lot of people really like. When you sit in a Mazda, no matter the price point, you sort of feel like you're sitting in something that is a bit more special, and there's a bit more thought and style to it. If you sit in the equivalent, say, Kia or Hyundai, you get more sort of thick black plastic stuff. I'm thinking the likes of, say, a CX-30 versus a Kona or something like that.
Right.
And I think in a lot of people's minds, also the styling has a lot to do with that, that push towards premium. There's maybe the styling does sort of eat into the interior practicality of a lot of their cars, but also it has a really good family look to it. But, yeah, I think the idea of Mazda moving towards BMW sort of levels is maybe a little bit far-fetched. I see Mazda more playing against the likes of the semi-premium Euros, like the Volkswagen, even Skoda in our market.
A bit of Volvo,
pretty much. And in the past, we've done a comparison test between a Lexus, Mazda, and a Volvo. That was a CX-30, XC40, and UX. And the idea of that was to see whether Mazda does stack up as an alternative to the premiums, because, you know, in some of their models, their prices are creeping up to that sort of premium price point zone. But, you know, also the likes of, yeah, Volkswagen, Skoda, Peugeot, those sorts of brands. And I do, like, as much as I love Chesto's newshound nature on this this sort of stuff, I have to call out, you know, calling it an X5 and X6 rival is probably a little bit misleading. In terms of the tail of the tape, the measuring tape, the size of this next generation car, according to the reports out of Japan, is 4620 millimeters long, 4,620 millimeters long. So that's actually shorter than a current generation X3. So it's nowhere near X5 in size, nor X6. It's more X3 and X4, and I think that's probably the right sort of game for that car to be playing. But on that new platform with the new six-cylinder engine, there's some interesting stuff about to happen. What do you reckon, Steve?
As Chesto would say, never let a wheelbase or an overall length get in the way of a good story. But, Steve, Matt was just throwing to you. It's as much about the emotion of the thing, isn't it? Like the brand. Is the Mazda brand something that people will pay a premium price for?
I think they will in Australia. I think, you know, if you look at Mazda and how Mazda has performed in Australia in the last, you know, decade, they haven't tried to do this overnight. There's been a subtle push and evolution of the brand. And it kind of reminds me of, you remember this, like, you know, Honda back in the late 80s, early 90s. They had a lot of, they had that semi-premium, that was sort of the Japanese BMW. And,
absolutely. You know,
cars like the Prelude and the Legend and things like that. So, you know, there's an argument that can be made. You know, obviously that didn't work out so well for Honda in the end. You know, they moved away from that strategy, you know, or just, you know, people just didn't buy into it. But, you know, I think, you know, given Mazda's, their long running stance of sort of moving away from the, you know, being driven by a price point and focused more on the higher end models and the quality, you know, it could work. I think, you know, Australian customers have sort of accepted Mazda to a degree as, you know, already as a semi-premium brand, you know. Are they going to compete with BMW? You know, whether it's an X3 or an X5, I think that is probably a bridge too far. But as we move forward, I can definitely see people being willing to spend that little bit more to get something a little bit nicer.
Just out of interest, I had a look at the price points for, say, an entry-level X5 and an entry-level CX5. In the US, which we all know is the measuring stick for how successful a brand is. The current CX-5 starts at $25,000 US.
Okay.
And the X-5 starts at $59,400.
Whoa!
Wow. So, I can't see Mazda going that premium.
But, and that's big money in America. I mean, that's big bucks. Yeah,
exactly. I was just going to say, I think that the idea of them using similar platforms to build different bodies or top hats, as they call them in the industry, on top of new platforms just makes sense. That's where the markets are going. It makes sense because you amortize the costs quicker, and also you can develop different body styles and play in niches, which is a really important part if you are a premium brand.
Yeah.
The other thing I would add to this, though, is we've got for Mazda, you know, like, you know, so internationally, they probably have to do something different. They can't keep doing what they've been doing.
Yes.
And so maybe that is a more upmarket push to, you know, try and do better in the US, try and do better in Europe, because otherwise, you know, if you keep stagnating, then, you know, you're sort of
it's interesting. It's, It's a great point you make, Steve, because I don't know about you guys, but whenever you're in, maybe it's Korea with Hyundai or Kia, the question inevitably comes, what is it about Mazda in Australia? Why is Mazda so successful in Australia? You're right, it is a bit of an outlier and maybe a test case as to whether things will work. But, I mean, typically a move to a more premium positioning means you're going to sacrifice a bit of volume for maybe some more margin on each car. However, Chesto went on to report that February sales would indicate they're in a pretty strong second position in the market, and more day-to-day products like BT50 are standing them in pretty good stead. So they're almost being able to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, I mean,
definitely. You guys said?
Yeah. And this is sort of what I was saying about Mazda. They have succeeded here. Australia is such a strong market for them. You know, the Australian consumer has, you know, they're buying what they're selling. You know, they this semi-premium, slightly more upmarket offering, and the value equation, like you say, the value equation of a Mazda versus a Lexus or a Volvo is pretty compelling. You know, like I think you know, Australians are dummies. You know, they can see a good deal when they spot it, and I think that's what is driving this. You know, I think you know, certainly there was a lot of stories written and there was a lot of questions asked when the latest Mazda 3 came out, because they did shed a lot of sales. But, you know, from their point of view, if they can make, you know, similar profit or more profit by selling less cars, happy days. But if then, like say, you add, you know, if they can shift more BT50s and whatnot, then it's just all gravy for them, isn't it?
Yeah, and Mazda at the time was saying, okay, people may not be buying threes, but they're buying CX-5s or you know, there are other options in our range. But I think to your point too, Matt, the design, they're looking, to my eyes anyway, really interesting and very sleek. But that Mazda 3 hatch, the over-the-shoulder view, if you want to try and catch the opposite lane, you are compromised. So they're obviously putting style and image very high in the priority list in terms of design.
Definitely. And I think also the one important point you made, Steve, is, you know, Lexus and Volvo, comparatively, the Mazdas stand up. But also, you can't buy yourself a $25,000 Lexus or Volvo. So, which you can do if you're buying a Mazda CX-3 or a Mazda 2. And even the lower grades of the CX-30 start at about $30,000, which is a good chunk under the premium brands when it comes to starting points. And that's how you get people in. They have a good experience with your brand and then they stick with you. And that's the hope that these sorts of brands have. And on the sales stuff, I noted, the BT50, I think there's a few factors with BT50 selling pretty well in February. So it was 1,015 sales for the month. Now, that is less than what Mazda told us they're hoping to get per month. That is between 1,200 and 1,300 a month, based on sort of 7 to 8% market share. Now, the point is, I think there's also a few buyers out there who maybe have gone, I can't wait 6 to 12 months for a D-Max X-Terrain, so I might get a Mazda to tide me over. Or maybe the Mazda's just as good an option for some people out there. And it is, you know, the ute market's cutthroat. So you can't escape the fact that there's just people out there that will buy what they need whenever they need it.
And shift wholesale to whatever's right at that minute. That's a point. The other thing I'd like to say is you can almost invert this. If you look at the likes of Mercedes-Benz, who over decades has gradually crept down into a more mainstream part of the market. You know, you've got Mazda with aspirations going up. Merc has slipped in, you know, okay, it started with A-Class, but then there's a whole range of models available around that that makes it much more affordable and realistic choice for people. So there's a blurring both ways for sure.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And also, it's hugely profitable to have a small platform and build 7 models off it. That's massively profitable because you're using so much of the same parts across different bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, ask Lee Iacocca in the, I want to say, late 70s, early 80s, the K-Series, I think, with Chrysler. He was a master of that. Brought them back from the brink. But I think the other good job that Mazda has done is at the retail kind of interface. They've built a really great network of dealers that provide, you know, I've had firsthand experience of it from time to time, that provide terrific customer experience. And that goes to underpinning a premium positioning as well. You really need to back it up, not only with the product, but the whole experience right the way through.
And yeah, I think Chesto had an experience like that himself when he had his CX-30 long-termer. If you watch the video review of that, you'll find it on our YouTube channel if you're watching there. There's interesting footage that he was sent when he took the car in for its first service. And so they send you a video file basically showing you what they're doing and running you through the car.
What?
Yeah, the tire, you know, the tire status, you know, letting you know if there are any potential issues. There weren't any, obviously, because it's only got 10,000 Ks on it. But, yeah, it was really interesting to see just the different approach. And, like, they gave him a voucher to go up the street to the cafe and grab a coffee and some brekkie. And he was in and out within an hour, which, you know, they understand that time is precious, and that's a really important part of a luxury ownership experience.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, I think we've moved to this era where cars are generally pretty good, right? There's not a lot of cars we drive that are just like a complete dud. And so the difference is how you treat your customers, right? Like, and I think that, the you know, as much as we, you know, sometimes have a laugh about this idea of the brand experience, you know, I think it's important. I think that's super important for people when they buy a car to have that, you know, good ownership experience where it's easy, it's convenient, it's, you know, it's trouble free. And it feels a bit easy. You know, we see that now with, you know, other brands like, you know, like Genesis trying to enter the luxury market, trying to do stuff way out there, like their concierge service, you know, like Lexus has done the same thing. Like, we're now having to really push the boundaries beyond just the cars and into like a whole new realm of the customer experience and everything around the brand to entice customers to A, come, and B, stay.
I think you make a good point about there being, you know, very few truly bad cars. I think don't know about you guys, the worst car I've ever driven, new car, is a photo finish tie between the Brock Lada Samara and the FSM 650 Nikki. They were equally horrendous. The Samara started to actually disintegrate around me as I was driving it. It was that bad. So you're right. The product is universally pretty good. It's all about the experience, and Mazda seems to deliver a very good job on that score.
Yeah,
definitely.
All right. Well, that's a really interesting conversation, and it'd be great to get people's feedback. Are you a current Mazda owner? What's your experience been? How do you see Mazda as a brand in the marketplace? Is it one you're willing to pay a premium on? Let us know your thoughts. That'd be great. But we are going to now move to our own garage. And Stephen, I want to start with you, please. Tell us about the vehicle that you've been driving recently.
Right. So it's interesting you just brought up the worst cars you've ever driven because I...
Oh!
Now, to be fair...
Wow!
Burn! This is not going to... The one of the worst cars I've ever driven was a Chery J1. I think it was called the J1, the little hatchback thing. And it was one of the first Chinese cars to try and have a crack in the Australian market. And it was pretty average, you know? I think the interior might have been designed by six or seven different people that did not talk to each other. I bring that up because the car I had been driving is the Chinese, although it sounds British, but the MG ZS EV, which I think shows how far the Chinese have come in a relatively short period of time. And, you know, I was actually, you know, obviously, as the name suggests, it's an electric car. And it is one of the most affordable electric cars you can buy. $43,990, which is pretty sharp. You know, it's a small SUV, but you know, when you look at that segment, you know, like, there's a lot of cars in that segment that are in the low to mid 40s range. So it's not like it's a million miles away. Yes, you can get a lot of ZS in the $20,000 range, but so it is a step up. But in terms of, you know, what you're actually getting, the size of vehicle and the powertrain, I think it's good value. And quite frankly, I thought it was an okay drive. You know, it's not class leading by any stretch, but, you know, if you're in the market, if you're one of those people that really wants to make the switch to electric, then I think there's a strong argument to make for the ZS because of the value, and you know the range is probably, you know, it's probably a generation behind now. We see more, you know, the better batteries in cars like the Hyundai Kona. You know that its range is around 230, probably around 200 real world. But you know, if you're you know, in a city dweller, if you know, like
that's,
you know,
plenty.
I found it fine. You know, I found it fine to drive around, do the school run, you know, go to the shops. Like it does the basics. And, you know, like, well, yes, there's areas it can improve. That they, you know, they could do some more with ride and handling, but you know, for what it was, I think it's worth consideration.
I've said it to a few people in the office that I think MG would be hugely benefited by having the Hyundai Kia approach of getting an engineering team to rejig the steering and suspension of their cars. Because, you know, on the whole, these vehicles are pretty impressive, especially for what you're paying. Like you say, Steve, there's ZS models. You can get a ZS now for 22,000 drive away, which is why you're seeing so many of them on the street, because they're good-looking cars. True. They don't do a whole lot wrong. And, you know, they've got good warranty as well, 7 years. So it's all stacking up pretty well for them, I think.
Yeah. Sorry, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting for me because I drove the ZST straight after it. I was impressed. You know, it's interesting. I'd written a lot of stories about their sales. You know, the MGs are roaring up the sales charts and giving a lot of very established brands, you know, a bit of a pain in the backside. But I can see why. Like you said, they're well presented inside. You know, like I said, the Chery was a mismatched disaster. But if you look at something like the MG, they've obviously taken, you know, this huge leap forward, you know, as an industry, you know, the Chinese car industry. It's a well-presented interior. It's got good tech. I 100% agree with Matt that, you know, a local ride and handling program would be hugely beneficial to them. Or, you know, look, or alternatively, you know, they could, you know, there's work. I think fundamentally they could be better cars. You know, they're not quite yet at the level of what we get with Hyundai and Toyota and things like that. But certainly, yeah, I can understand why these cars are so popular now, because you know, it's good bang for your buck, so to speak.
I think it's pretty telling that in comparing the MG to other more established cars, all of a sudden Hyundai and Toyota can be mentioned in the same breath. You know, where only a decade and a half ago, Hyundai was still seen as a step below. I think Hyundai and Kia have joined Toyota, Mazda, et cetera, as the mainstream and every bit as good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it'll take too long for these Chinese car makers that we see, like MG, to be in that same sort of conversation. You know, I think they are catching up faster than a lot of people give them credit for. You know, I think.
Where did you charge it, Steve? Were you just charging it from house power, or did you go to a charging station, or how did that work?
No, I actually charged it publicly. I charged it at the local shops. You know, because. Yep. It was convenient. You know, I had to go to the local shops. It's near my daughter's school, so I was able to sort of plug it in, give it half an hour of charging. It would just, generally speaking, just kind of top it up. You know, I never really stretched the range, because, you know, I'd go every couple of, you know, within, you know, 3 or 4 days, you'd charge it up and, you know, you topped it up and away you went.
And you get the good parking spot.
Yeah. Well, assuming there's no Teslas, this is the interesting thing about electric cars. I've had driven a couple lately, and, you know, my local shopping center that has around, I don't know, you've got to guess, 3,000, 4,000 parking spots, has a whole two electric charging spots.
Okay. And yes.
I have found in my experience, when I've tried to use public charging, about 90% of the time it's full of Teslas. You know, they're a bit ubiquitous. Yep. And so you end up with just, you know, it can be a little frustrating trying to charge when you're like, you know, these Teslas all the time just have been soaking up all the juice.
Cool. No, well, that's interesting. So an affordable option. Very interesting. Thank you, Steve. And Matt, we will move on to yourself. We've been talking about Peugeot lately. They're still a pretty small target in this market, but you've been in something that's a bit interesting.
Yeah, so as you can see, if you're watching on YouTube, the car behind me is the New Peugeot 3008. Well, not new. It's the facelifted version of that car. It's actually, I mean, I've always thought the 3008 is a gorgeous looking small to mid, well, it's actually a mid-size SUV. And it's even better looking now. They've managed to tweak the grille, do some different stuff with the headlights, and it still retains the same sort of, you know, chunky but quite petite. I don't know how that works, silhouette. And also the rear's got new tail lights as well. You'll see all this if you're watching on the YouTube show. And it's, I mean, the thing with Peugeot, it's not playing for volume. And thankfully, because they would never achieve it with the prices that they're asking. So the base model car, that's not the one you see there. The one I'm driving is the GT petrol, but the base model car is $45,000 plus on road costs.
Yeah.
And then the GT petrol, that one there's $48,000 plus it's got a few options on it. Then there's the GT diesel at about $51,000. And the GT Sport is a $55,000 car.
Okay.
So it is definitely in the likes, in the competition zone against, say, like an Audi Q2, the Volvo XC40, the Lexus UX, all of which are slightly smaller competitors. But on that price point, that's sort of where you're looking at. Otherwise, you're looking at very high-end versions of RAV4, Tucson and Sportage. And I guess CX-5 is one we have to include in that conversation as well. In a previous life, I've done a comparison between a CX-5 and a 3008 and the 3008 won.
Previous life, you were also the son of a sultan living in a very large... Yeah, anyway, sorry.
And it was a butterfly.
yeah, that's right.
but the 3008, it's an interesting car. It's got the Peugeot Eye cockpit interior, so you have to sit with the steering wheel down low and look over the top of it. There's new screens. The materials are all really nice and pleasant. It's a pretty nice car to drive. Obviously, there's the 5008 that sits above it, which is the 7-seat version. It's longer and has the rear seats as well. But the thing I think might be the interesting point for this car is when the plug-in hybrid version arrives later this year. There won't be a fully electric 3008, but a plug-in hybrid might add a little bit more interest and might be able to help justify the asking price of this car. But stay tuned. We'll be doing a full detailed video review and written piece of the 2021 range coming soon. So keep your eyes out for that.
Cool. Cool. Interesting. Thank you. I will chip in at the end here. I've been driving a VW, the new T6.1 version. This one's a Transporter, TDI 250 manual. So it's the entry point to this whole lineup. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's the case, Matt.
You are bang on. It's
2-litre turbo diesel, 4-cylinder, producing a staggering 81 kilowatts and 250 newton meters. But those newton meters arrive at 1,250 RPM. So, look, just above idle. It's front-wheel drive. And it's $38,990 is the price. And you're getting a lot of vehicle for that money. And actually, even though it's only 250 newton meters, you do get lots of pulling power low down. It might be a combination of the gearing and the engine characteristic, but it gets along perfectly fine. Now, I did not drive the car laden. It was empty the whole time I had it, but I really enjoyed the high mount kind of 5-speed manual coming out of the dash. That's a bit of a Euro thing. I know some of the French brands are fond of that as well. Love that. On 16-inch steel rims, which I liked as well. And a good ride for a commercial van, especially unladen. It gets along and it's quite comfy. You're not compromised in that area. It steers nicely as well. And the turning circle, 11.9 meters isn't small, but it's not vast either. And it will turn really sharply. And you have a good driving position, which I was thinking of myself as being a tradie or someone using that vehicle day-to-day for work. Boy, they're in a good position, quite literally. And you get that side door, rear door versatility. I think it's got a lot to recommend it. The only niggles I could find with it really was the handbrake is very low down on the floor, but you have a kind of heel hold function anyway. So when you're stopped and ready to move from lights on a hill, you're kind of taken care of on that score. It's a little bit noisy. And the side vision, because it's a closed panel type van, is a bit, you take some getting used to, but the mirrors are nice and big and it's not a drama. I really enjoyed driving it. I thought it was great.
And JC, it's probably the only car under, well, over $30,000 that has a 5-speed manual gearbox.
Yes, yes. And can I say that I did not once reach for a 6th gear that wasn't there. I was so conscious of the fact that it was a 5-speed and loved it that I didn't do that. But I found it a really enjoyable experience driving that van. And I was constantly trying to get in the headspace of a tradie and thinking this would be paradise. There were lots of little storage areas around. It's got a cigarette lighter. Not a 12-volt outlet, very naughty. I enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Awesome. Wow. Must be one of the few cars left with a cigarette lighter.
I know. I thought very naughty. Now let's just move on to the feedback that we had after last week's show. And we are back on YouTube, which is fantastic. So our listeners as opposed to viewers have been uninterrupted service, but YouTube, we weren't hacked, but YouTube thought we were. And we had some toing and froing to get back on deck. But Chesto and Crafty got a lot of love from many viewers and listeners last week. And Anisu Brivacare says, finally, I can stream Crafty's beautiful face on the big screen again. Oh, and there was a Cars Guide response that I know I didn't put in there. And I've got a feeling, I know who it was. It says, it's even better in person, !! And
I think that's a sentiment we can all agree on.
Given that Crafty had taken it upon himself to answer a few other comments, I can put two and two together who came up with that. The other thing was, Dukul came in and said, g'day guys, spotted another Crafty Edition 4-wheel drive on sale by a Japanese importer. Now, we were talking, Crafty's background last week on the Zoom was Les Hiddens in his Land Rover. And we discovered that there was a Crafty Edition Land Rover, little known, short-lived special edition that also had a disco mirror ball inside the car. So DeCook spotted one. Crafty didn't even mention it. It's a Pajero Mini, has all the options included, all the boxes ticked, all the fruit inside and out. I'm pretty sure I even see the glittering disco ball inside through the tinted window. So fantastic. And we've got pics of that vehicle for people watching on YouTube. Now, part of what we spoke about with the LC300 was this new engine, 3.3-litre turbo diesel V6. And Hammerrock says he has no doubt that if Toyota says that it will outperform the 4.5-litre turbo diesel V8 in the 200 series, then it will. But what he'd like to know is how it will deliver that power and torque. You know, will it be delivered at a leisurely and unstressed way as per the V8? Or will it be wringing its cylinders off to make power and torque figures? And that could impact its longevity and possibly its reliability. I think that's a valid point. We were talking about smaller capacity engines like Ranger and Hilux, et cetera. So look, in a way, time will tell, but this bigger engine will have a bigger job to do.
Mm-hmm.
So good point, Hammer. Jaylene Andrews. Now, this is a really interesting comment. I think this person has some insight into the behind the scenes at Toyota. Would not be recommending towing with Toyota's 4-cylinder diesel in the Prado and Hilux. The amount of warranty claims going through for blown turbos, diesel particulate filter, and cracked pistons is out of control. They're okay as a people mover. As for towing a 2.5 to 3.5 ton trailer, snap out of it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're all well familiar with the DPF type issues that have been plaguing Toyota for some time. Blown turbos and cracked pistons sounds pretty tragic. Have you guys, either of you, heard any of that?
No, I haven't. But that doesn't mean it hasn't happened. The brands are pretty savvy with the sort of information they tell you about. And dealerships, unless you're in with dealerships, you might not know about these sorts of things. So maybe commenter knows a little bit more because they are playing on the inside of the fence, so to speak.
That's right. But so if Jaylene Andrews is going by their real name, then that'd be an interesting conversation in a service department at a particular Toyota dealership.
It could also be a group of maybe three people who have had a very specific issue,
that's right.
And they make
that's
a lot of noise on a forum. Yeah. That has happened before.
Look, yeah, I mean, it could just be a group of owners, car club type thing, where situation where you get, but that's, if you're getting multiple people having the same problem, then that's a problem, that's an issue.
Now, Sukhoi Romanik, who we assume has a love affair with Russian fighter planes, says if making a Gazoo Racing on-road SUV, wouldn't Toyota better spend the money on a fast Kluger, aka Dodge Durango SRT? And that's an interesting thought. Anyway,
I think he's probably the only person who's ever had that thought.
That's right.
Are we also thinking Toyota has a budget problem? I feel like they could develop. Obviously, they've partnered on 86 and Supra, but I feel like if they could want to develop a car, they'll find the penny somewhere.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Now, Oggy has come out with a veiled threat and said that 6-cylinder diesel better be offered in a Prado spec. And Chris G responded to him and said, would be amazing, but that would put the Prado almost at Land Cruiser price and spec. So what do you guys make of that?
I think there's room for both. If there was a high-grade Prado, I mean, the current high-grade Prado is 100 grand anyway. So it's inching closer. And, I mean, if you're looking at what the actual market prices are at the moment, a high-grade Prado is what a 200 series used to cost. So,
exactly.
I think there's a market for both.
Yeah, I would sort of suggest, again, do we think Toyota has a problem selling Prados and Land Cruisers? There's no evidence that they have any issue selling either of those cars in significant volume consistently. So,
look, the other thing, the undeniable fact is you don't want to cross Oggy. He is prone to wild behaviour. So if Toyota's listening in, just be sensible about these things. You don't want to poke that bear.
No.
But in terms of poking the bear, it is time to move on to Muskwatch. Okay, first of all, during the week, Bernie Sanders, now most listeners and viewers will be familiar with Bernie Sanders, the curmudgeonly Democrat who has been in just about every recent presidential race, captured the imagination of various people, but dropped out at a certain stage. He tweeted, "We are in a moment in American history where two guys, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, own more wealth than the bottom 40% of people in this country. That level of greed and inequity is not only immoral, it is unsustainable." So, many took him to task on the greed bit, particularly, and the point being that Elon's wealth is largely a factor of Tesla's share price. So he's not actually sitting on piles of gold or necessarily rolling in as much cash as you might otherwise think. For example, Clean Technica came in and said, look, attacks on Elon Musk for his wealth are ridiculous. And this was on Twitter. And Elon responded to that saying, "I am accumulating resources to help make life multiplanetary and extend the light of consciousness to the stars." That's what he said. That's what he said.
I think we can all get on board with that. I mean, that's just sentiment I think we all share. That's why I earn money. No, okay. I mean, putting aside obviously Bernie's questions about greed. I mean, that's a deep conversation in and of itself. I find this whole Musk's obsession with trying to make Mars habitable a bit like, house is messy. You haven't cleaned up in a while.
Yep.
Let's just buy a new house.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's just dump this one. And there are some issues that we need to deal with. Obviously, again, it's a deep political discussion, but climate change and whatnot. But I think Mars is probably, with all the problems, I still on Earth, I still feel that Mars is slightly less habitable. There's a little bit more work to be done to make it more habitable compared to Earth, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting, like, Steve, because Bernie came back and said space travel is an exciting idea, but right now we need to focus on Earth and create a progressive tax system so children don't go hungry, people aren't homeless, blah, 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 blah. So he was literally grounding it in planet A rather than thinking about, you know, planet B. Mm-hmm. And Matthew M. Heitman, PhD, responded by saying, I'm extorting resources to help make capitalism multiplanetary and extend my massive ego to the stars. Fixed it for you. You're welcome. And the aptly named Rich Ortiz says, the rich can imagine a time when they leave the rest of us. And that, I thought, was a really poignant statement. Mm-hmm. When you think there are close to 8 billion people on Earth by most approximations, not everyone's going to be going to Mars. This is about rich people finding some kind of other option to get on a spaceship. And Liam said, you trade in apocalypse marketing for the wealthy. It's fine if that's the hill you want to die on. Just be honest about it.
Mm.
It isn't the electric truck for every man. He was talking about the Cybertruck. It's the car for the rich to ride out Mad Max. it's totally true. Everything he does, you've got to pay for. The tunnels, that's not for everyone. That's not to find a new way of mass transit. It's for rich people to sidestep traffic jams. Now, then, Jared Yates Sexton, and thank you to Peter Anderson, who alerted me to this response, said, you're drowning in debt. Your loved ones are living shorter lives. Your friends are searching for food in dumpsters and about to be evicted. And Flash Gordon over here is accumulating resources to help make life multiplanetary and extend the light of consciousness to the stars. but Jared, what have we got? In case you're worried about people not being able to afford it, Elon said on Twitter in January, he intends there to be loans available for those who don't have money and jobs on the red planet for colonists to pay off their debts. So really, you're talking about indentured service.
I was going to say, it's indentured service.
It's kind of slavery. It's slavery on Mars, really. Yeah.
That's excellent.
Wow.
So just to be clear, slavery on Mars so you can continue to exist. Either die here or work for your life over there. Like,
precisely. Precisely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, you sent me an Elon tweet, which I thought deserved a mention as well.
Yeah.
And he said, if there's ever a scandal about me, please call it Elongate, which I thought was, you know, pretty good. But, and in fact, Illuminilation came back and said, this tweet is the first worthwhile thing you've ever said or done. Congrats. So
nice. You know, I have to say that is actually a pet peeve of mine, is every scandal becomes a gate, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
It's lazy journalism, and it drives me nuts because it has nothing to do with Watergate and it has nothing to do with the gate. But I will say Elongate is actually clever. Like, that's clever.
You're just having flashbacks of Otleygate, which actually played out over a period of years. I mean, I know you don't like to talk
about it, but James, charges were laid. There was no one was said. Hurt. So the things, look, things were said. Things are forgotten about, okay?
I've still got the photos, though, Steve.
I'm pretty sure the document was binding that you cannot share those. And okay. Yep. I'm not even sure we could be talking about this.
Things on the internet never die. Anyway, look, the share price for Tesla, which we normally check in on, it's down. $630, down about $70. It was $701 last week. And it actually is at the low point for the week. It's been on this trend. And ARK Invest, run by the influential, this is CNN reporting, Cathie Wood, she's a bit of a TED talker, a creative thinker, expects Tesla shares to reach at least $3,000 by 2025. That's a 350% rise, okay? Now, get what this is based on. That's more than double ARK's own $1,400 price target it set last year. This is on the basis of increased assumptions for Tesla's ability to efficiently use its capital to finance ambitious growth plans. Factor in gains it expects Tesla to reap from selling car insurance, an upcoming robo-taxi, ride-hailing service that Musk has promised, and ARC believes there is a 50% chance Tesla will be able to achieve fully autonomous driving by 2025, and that such a service would add $160 billion in annual profits by 2025.
Have you guys seen the FSD beta videos that have been doing the rounds as
No, fill us in.
Oh, there's a bunch of people who have got the full self-driving beta download, and you know they're testing it, filming the results, and just seeing just how bad this thing is at full self-driving. It isn't good.
No, it's level two.
Yeah, yeah. It's
Just to clarify, James, did that ARC statement, did they talk about when the Tesla unicorn is coming out?
That's right.
After 2025?
It will definitely arrive in 2017.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yep. I think that's 100% chance.
Well, they are
kidding themselves.
That's right, because in October 21, 2019, the dear leader said, next year for sure, we will have over 1 million robo-taxis on the road. That's what he said. It was bizarre at the time, and it's even more bizarre now. So this person, Kathy Wood, is absolutely drinking the Elon Kool-Aid. And Gordon Johnson of GLJ Research, who's been a frequent critic of this person, says, a picture emerges of a potentially flawed, misinformed model, in our opinion. And putting it that basically the competition is going to swamp Tesla anyway. That all of this is predicated on Tesla still being out as a first mover and on its own and no one else actually catching up.
How many electric cars will be on the market by 2025 from these big brands? From
absolutely.
You know, we've seen Hyundai Ioniq 5 this week, the Kia EV6, you know.
Yeah,
Volkswagen's announced all these plans to have much of its
ID4 and on it goes. Yeah.
But they've already announced all those plans beyond the current MEB. Like, so the market is about to be, particularly in Europe, is going to be flooded affordable, well built. Yeah,
Kathy Wood, like Elon, is a pretty keen tweeter, and she was on there, and Ash said, you know that this dream of AI-driven taxis on city streets dropping you off at the airport is not coming true in the next 10 years. Hope you're making the right assumptions about the future cash flows. And another guy called Crypto Oma just said, keep stroking Musk. And Razor Raymond, pump it up, love it, to the moon. As in, she's just trying to pump up the Tesla stock for whatever reason. She's either refusing to kind of accept alternate points of view or just not investigating carefully enough, because it just seems totally far-fetched to me.
Here's one, hands up if you want to get into a taxi with no driver.
It's true.
Who wants to get into a taxi with a driver?
But this is actually another question, you know, going back to you know the original point with Bernie was making. You know, we're effectively going to, you're talking about killing an industry. You're talking about getting rid of a whole job. You know, I was sort of curious with Uber drivers. You know, I sort of have a tendency to ask them, so are you okay with Uber effectively using the money you pay them to work out your replacement? They want self-driving cars and they're funneling this money into, you know, like things like Uber and Airbnb have, you know, sort of allowed individuals to take on, you know, a job and have this, you know, we've created this new economy and now we're already talking about getting rid of it. I mean, look, obviously that's more of a philosophical question, but I just think personally, I'm not hopping into a car without a driver. As bad as, you know, we may, you know, as much as we joke about taxi drivers, you know, and they're not great,
no,
at least they're, you know, there's some level of default human predilection to make sure you don't have a crash. You know,
I've often thought, you know, okay, I'm going to get in a cab that is in pretty poor condition. I know that diff was probably needed to be replaced about 100,000 kilometers ago. The tires aren't what they should be. The whole thing is kind of rattling and falling to pieces. The driver's horrendous, overly aggressive. I think I'd be better off driving at 0.05 than actually getting in this car.
But this, I mean, this is why Uber has succeeded so well, right? Because it's people with their own car, so they care about it. And this is my argument most of the time with AI versus the human thing. And you know, I think it was Google that said, you know, they want to get rid of the human being out of driving. You know, so that's the key to me. I'm not convinced that's right. Yeah, humans make mistakes, but I mean.
Yeah,
I personally have had a lot of problems with technology. I think we've all, at some point, got the blue screen of death. You know,
well, it's an engineering it's an engineering approach, isn't it? Engineer out the problem. What's the weakest link? Engineer it out of the equation. I remember I had it explained to me once by during the Industrial Revolution, the normal dress for men at that stage included a necktie, and there were machines like lathes or other things where these ties were being caught in machines. And people were being killed. And despite, look, don't wear your tie, people still wore them. The human was the weak link. And a rest or a guard engineered out the problem. So it no longer, but so it's just taking that to another level and saying, take the human out of the equation.
Yeah, well, I've got mates who's a software engineer who's like, I'm never driving a self-driving car. You know, I know what I do. And it's because this is the thing. We talk about it as, the computer removes the human, but the computer is programmed by a human.
A human,
you know, like I, you know, I found in my experience, whenever I've been, you know, confronted with a situation on the road that requires immediate action, you know, there is a computer in the car already. It's the brain, the human brain processes information. And I've avoided all these accidents just through instinct. You know, human instinct is to avoid harm.
Yeah,
right? Exactly. And so you naturally do that. You naturally process all the information you need to process fast enough that it's okay. I mean, I think, again, it's a philosophical question, but this whole idea of a zero road toll is great. And obviously, I don't want anyone to die on the road. But we have to remember that driving a car is not, you know, a right. It's a privilege. You have to, it's 2 tons of metal that can go over 100 kilometers an hour. You know, you can run people down if you want. You know, like you have to have a certain level of responsibility, personal responsibility, you know, and common sense to be driving cars, you know.
It's like, true.
And I think taking that stuff out is silly.
Yeah. You know? All right. It's a whole other podcast. Let's keep that one on the shelf. Interesting also, the only reason Uber isn't profitable is because of its investment in self-driving. Mm-hmm. It would be a very profitable company without that. But anyway, look, I think we have reached the finish line. And I want to say thank you to Matt.
Thank you.
And thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
And thanks to our chief paper folder, seasonal mall Santa, and head of all things awesome, Mr. Pritchard, for his deft recording skills. This week, he's wearing a T-shirt saying, remember, if we get caught, you're deaf and I don't speak English. Donald Trump lift you up pants and a cap saying, I pee in pools. stepping into his shoes on post-production this time is Mr. Sullivan, who strangely enough dresses like a normal human being. Thank you, Brett. Let us know your thoughts. You can find Cars Guide on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. If you're an Apple Podcast listener, please rate and review us. Remember, you can always also watch us on YouTube. Isn't it great to be back there? And if you are already, make sure you subscribe to the Cars Guide YouTube channel so you can stay on top of all our latest content. But before we go, a nasty pair of jumper leads walks into a pub, menacing looking thing. Right off the bat, the publican says, look, I'll serve you a drink, just don't start anything.
Oh, God.
Oh, dear.
They just get more dad.
Yeah. I am a dad.
Yeah. That was good. Because jumper leads start things. That's the joke.
Yeah.